Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome to the Beer Ladies podcast with your hosts, Lisa, Katie, Christina, and myself, Tandy. You can find us at our website or all over social media. Our website is beerladiespodcast.com, and our social media, Twitter, Instagram, Mastodon, Blue Sky, TikTok, and even Facebook are at Beer Ladies Pod or Beer Ladies Podcast. If you'd like to support the show, you can find our merch store link on any of our social media bios or in the show notes for this episode. And if you'd like to sponsor an episode, do mail us at beerladiespodcast@gmail.com. Now back to the beer.
Hi, friends. Welcome back to the Beer Ladies Podcast. My name is Christina, and I'm here today with my co-host, Lisa, and a very special guest, Susan Flavin. And I'm so excited that she's here, and I can't wait to talk to her. If you are not familiar, she is a beer historian extraordinaire who has been getting up to all kinds of experimental archaeology lately, and we just can't wait to talk to her. But before we dig into that, we're going to start with the perennial favorite. What are you drinking? And I'm going to start with asking our guest, Susan, what are you drinking?
I am drinking a groot ale from a microbrewery, which is across the road from where I'm living at the moment, called Kettlesmith. And they've made it in collaboration with Woolley Grange Hotel, which is a 17th century manor house here in Bradford and Avon. And they've brewed it with some fresh herbs from the kitchen garden there, which is really nice. And it's a really nice, quite red coloured beer. There is some hops in it, but it's not hoppy at all. It's quite fruity. It's really very good.
And Lisa, what are you drinking?
I am drinking, this will probably come as no surprise to our regular listeners, but I have a Ballycloughaven Bembricks Brown, because this is my sort of weekday go-to, or really my whenever I have a chance go-to. So always a reliable, and you know, again, it's got that sort of lovely rubyish color. It looks darker on screen, but always a pleasure to have that. Although I'm looking forward to getting a couple of bottles of their mild that's just come out as well. So that might be a future episode.
Oh yes, nice mild. I haven't had one in a while. That sounds epic. And I am being probably a little boring, and I'm just drinking a strawberry and banana smoothie because I feel like I'm getting sick again, friends. I don't know what is going on with me this year. But anyway, enough moaning. So Susan, I guess the first question I really want to ask you is beer history. How did you get into beer history? What drew you to beer history? Tell us all about that.
I suppose technically I'm not really a beer historian, I'm more a food historian, and I kind of came to beer because we were looking at, it's part of a much bigger project on food. We're looking at sort of isotope analysis, looking at household accounts, looking at what's in pots, you know, the lipid analysis of pots, so all kinds of ways of examining food. And the idea with beer was that it is the one food that you can look at in great detail, much more detail than any other food, because there's such good documentary evidence for that. So that was kind of a way of sort of integrating practice-based history and really looking at in minute forensic detail at one foodstuff. And of course, beer is really exciting because it's consumed in such huge quantities. It's such a vital part of diet. It seemed a really good place to start in terms of understanding nutrition and social, you know, social change and cultural change at the same time as well.
Absolutely.
And I think we're both, I'll just say quickly, we're both very excited, or at least I'm very excited, because this is a chance for me to use my archaeology degrees, which otherwise are just sitting somewhere in a box. So this absolutely counts. Very excited about this. Although again, I'll say, I'm coming to this not knowing as much. My training is as a prehistorian, so I can talk about the old stuff, but this stuff, I'm like, oh, I need to learn. I don't know as much of the more, you know, recent, which I'm air quoting. So.
And this is Christina's period as well, though, isn't it, Christina? Yeah. You've worked on 16th century brewing as well, and especially women in brewing.
Yeah, that's, I'm more lean towards sort of an anthropological approach. So mm-hmm. why and how and like what that said about society is really like what I'm profound. I mean, I'm profoundly interested in all of it, like, to be honest, like I could nerd out about this stuff for ages. And I'm so excited to find someone else who's studying Irish beer history to nerd out with for a little bit today. This is my favorite. I love, you know, this is just so fun. So Lisa and I got to go see your documentary just a month ago, 2 months ago.
Thereabouts, yeah.
Which was amazing. Can you kind of talk about, oh gosh, there's probably so much to talk about. So let's start with the beginning there. What was the project that led to the documentary? So how did that all start?
So the project's part of the Food Cult Project, and it's a 5-year project, and this was one part of that. And so we recreated a beer from Dublin Castle from 1574, because we had incredibly detailed records for that. We made an ordinary beer because we wanted to understand what servants there were drinking, not a strong beer. We know that 80% of what they were making was an ordinary beer. And we did that. We brought together lots of people. So people with experience in experimental archaeology. Mark Meltonville, our brewer, has a huge network of contacts who could build the equipment. And we worked with microbiologists. We worked with agronomists, people who understand sort of ancient cereals, landrace cereals and that. With the museum as well. So we were able to brew it in a 16th century kitchen, which they let us transform into a brew house. We sort of did it from start to finish. And the film crew followed the process basically from the manuscript room at Trinity College, where we sort of, you know, looked at the documents right through the fields and sort of the process of building things all the way to the end product, sort of to capture the sort of the other bits that you can't get into an academic paper. So the sensory aspects of it, and you can't recreate smells and stuff really on a film, but you know, the bits that creative storytellers are interested in, how the grain moves in the wind and what the wort looks like trickling down on an oak barrel, and those, you know, those bits to sort of bring it to life in a different way for people as well.
Yeah, and those bits did look beautiful too. I'm sure it could be, you know, I'm sure it's a long day when you're sort of getting some of those more visual elements together, but it really did come out beautifully. And I think it was quite atmospheric as well, that you would, like you say, sort of the barley just sort of wafting around in the breeze. And
it looks like it all happened very naturally, but it took hours and hours and hours of standing in a field while the barley blew around to get that. And you know, all the sort of light, the light in that building was just incredible, because it's a 16th century house, and it has sort of it's very dark inside, but they waited for ages to just get the light hitting the coming in the window and hitting the equipment and that. And the same at Warminster at the maltings. They spent ages really carefully watching the tasks and sort of trying to, you know, transmit the physicality of the work into the film as well. So a lot of care was put into all of those aspects of it.
Yeah.
And can you just tell our listeners before we get too far what the name of the documentary is?
Good call.
It's called Drunk. It's called Drunk Adventures in 16th Century Brewing. And it'll be available very soon for everybody to watch. It'll be open access, and we'll have a link to it on our Food Cult website, which is foodcult.eu.
Oh, that'll be
amazing.
Wonderful. Oh, we can't wait. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we want to watch it again. It was great, because I think it really does get that balance right of both being like really informative but also entertaining. Like, you know, sometimes those can go too far in one way or the other, and I think it really struck a nice
that was
nice
an
balance.
Accident, you know, it wasn't ever nobody was more surprised by me when people were laughing, because it was never meant to be, you know, comedic in any way, but I think it kind of did come across that way, because it's such a ridiculous question, isn't it, really, where people are drunk all the time and people sort of get on board with that, the journey to discover that. But yeah, I was surprised people laughed so much during it.
Actually, maybe that's a good place. And Christina, feel free to keep me honest, though, just to sort of maybe start with, like, was there a reason that particular recipe was chosen to work with? Because I know, Christina, you looked through a lot of these recipes yourself. Did this one just kind of have more information, or did it seem more kind of typical, if you like? Or what was the kind of thought process there?
Yeah, it did. It's part of a really detailed set of accounts where you even have sort of, you know, what's consumed on a day-to-day basis. So you can put it into the context of other foods. You've got an idea how many people are dining there because you know how many messes of food are served. So you can work out approximately how much is being consumed. But then you have these accounts attached to the kitchen accounts where you've literally got how much of each type of malt is used every time it's brewed, and how much beer is produced from that volume of malt, which is critical to understanding what we wanted to know, because we weren't really that interested in taste or anything like that. We really wanted to know, you know, could we get close to understanding the ABV, what would be the nutritional content of that, and to do that we needed to know what was produced, how much volume we got. So we back projected to get to exactly what was produced, and it's rare to find that level of detail. You don't find that in brewing directions, really, or, you know, in other, you know, in recipes as such. And also because it's a continuous set of records for a couple of years, we knew that what we were doing was typical, because it's really standard what they brew through time. So, yeah, it was a very, very, and how much hops is used for a given volume of beer, and the relative amounts of oat and barley malt and that. So it was all there, really. So it was quite exciting to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for our, you know, those modern brewers out there, especially the ones who are maybe sick of all the hazy things with oats, like there they were. So everything old is new again. It's 'twas ever thus, to a certain extent. Yeah.
As Christina probably knows, I mean, this one was 50% oat malt, but the ones, the Christchurch Cathedral ones from the same period are up to 100% oat beers.
Oh, gosh. Wow.
I can't imagine how difficult it would be to brew that, but also what it tasted like.
Yeah, chewy.
Chewy, yeah.
Delicious. We'll have to make one and find out.
Exactly. Yes.
Science.
This does sound like a project. No, I really, really enjoyed the documentary. I liked the use of animation that was put throughout of it. And it was really funny, but it was also really informative. So I think one of the things that struck me, which I was really happy to see you all confirm, was that the beer that you made was not this no to low alcohol beer, which is commonly something that you find touted by, oh, well, you know, the beer was very low ABV, so that's why they drank it all the time. So I wondered if you could speak a little bit about that.
Oh, it's such a persistent idea, and no one seems to know. And people get really angry about it on comments. If I do, you know, like, what's she talking about? Doesn't she know that she's forgotten about small beer? I mean, there is no evidence. We have no evidence in Ireland. At this institution, for example, there was no small beer produced at all. There were two types of beer. We know from dietary records, you know, dietary advice, that small beer was considered very unsuitable for working adults. And beer was considered a very healthy, very nutritious drink, and was provided in huge quantities for them as well. So small beer is where it's mentioned, it tends to be suitable for infants or for the sick, but would be very, very unsuitable for workers. And workers have agency. If they don't like what they're getting, they won't work, or they'll complain. And we've got records of that as well. So it's kind of, again, this misnomer that people just accept what they're given. People have a right to sort of demand good quality beer, and they do. And you find that there seems to be a correlation between the harder people work, the better quality, or the stronger the beer that they're provided, or the, you know, increased quantities of beer as well. So small beer, probably if you've nothing else to drink, or maybe in times of grain shortage, but it's not widely consumed, certainly not by workers who need calories to sustain what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought that was so interesting.
I think it might be on the one of the exam courses over here. A levels or one of the other. Yeah, it seems to be on a curriculum somewhere, and it's just passed on and on, and there's never been any evidence for it. It's just one of those really, really the 2% myth.
Yeah, it's up there with the, oh, they made the beer because the water wasn't safe. Like, no, no, no. Stop.
It's like this idea that just because they drank it a lot, well, we can't visualize. I think sometimes, especially like maybe in academia, this idea that people also like to drink for fun. So we're like, oh no, it's really serious. It was part of nutrition, and it's like, yeah, but it was also part of a good time. Like, and there's plenty of evidence for that as well. And it, for some reason, sometimes I think there's this idea like it can't also be fun. And then if it is, then it's not something for maybe serious study. Like if we say, you know, like sometimes people got drunk, and that's definitely a thing. There's so much evidence of that.
Yeah.
Or there's evidence of just not drinking small beer all the time. And however that worked out with the nutritional needs given across the day and the kind of work they were working, it might have been a very different thing than, you know, someone drinking like 5 pints back to back at a bar at night, you know? But yeah, I just sometimes wonder why that is just so incredibly persistent, and it just does not go away. Neither of them, the water one too, very persistent. Yeah,
and we've no idea. I mean, we know what's consumed in some context as part of the working day, but we've no idea how much people consume on top of that for leisure. And there's so much complaints about drunkenness in this period, but again, it's this moral panic that pops up in history through time. For, you know, if it's not gin later, it's sugar at some point, and it's beer at some point, and it's this kind of moral worry about sort of alehouses and disorder and things like that sort of suggest there was a lot of drinking. But again, it seems there's not a problem. I don't know what you think about this, Christina, but it seems to be in the records that I read, there's not a problem with drinking. Being drunk is the problem, really. So it's drinking. Moralists, it's absolutely fine to drink for work, and it's fine for you know, the Lord Deputy at Dublin Castle to give people 8 or 9 pints a day, and those same people are the ones that are complaining about drunkenness. So it's quite interesting what's going on. Is it just a really high tolerance for drunkenness, or is it the behavior that you exhibit when you're drunk, is that the problem? But yeah, in itself, drink is fine and even necessary for your health, but it's being drunk, to intentionally get drunk, that seems to be where the sin in this period. Mm. Yeah,
this idea of intentionally losing control.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, or that tippling, sitting in the alehouse all day because it's seen as really wasteful, you're not being productive, you're not working, you're not industrious, so that's a problem as well. But drinking for fuel is fine.
That's so interesting. It's all about the context. Like, everything this totally makes sense, though, that and you know, as ever, when we're looking at the records, you know, we see what people complained about, we don't see the things they didn't complain about. So it's still like, you know, it's like the TripAdvisor of the, you know, 16th century. So it's someone was angry about something.
But there has been so much good research done in recent years on the more positive cultures of the alehouse. This idea always that, oh, people were poor and they were miserable and they drank to forget their worries. And that's sort of, that's kind of what Christina was suggesting a while ago, isn't it? But that's kind of been debunked a lot, and people are much more interested now in the positive aspects of the rituals of drinking and what that meant in terms of sociability and male identity as well, and things like that. And there's been great sort of anthropological, historical studies on what drinking healths meant and what really happened in the alehouse, you know, what people did there and that. So it's an interesting new view on drinking in recent years.
Yeah, there's evidence, which I will show you in my book about the medieval stuff, and Irish stuff. There's poems and stuff that were definitely designed to be read out loud to drinkers, probably in alehouses. And they're funny, and they're definitely showing people were having a good time. And this is in Ireland. So, you know, I mean, there's plenty of evidence that this was a fun thing to do. Enjoy yourself. We're going to entertain you with all of these fun stories. And this is, you know, this is a great place to be. This is a place to find community. This is a place to hang out with your friends, or, you know, make business deals, or, you know, marry off, you know, your kids to your neighbor, or, you know, all of those sorts of conversations that we have different versions of now. You know, the alehouse has functioned much the same as it always has. And it's a place people had fun.
It's really cool that you've got evidence of that, because we have a lot less, don't we, in Ireland than for other. There's kind of always been that idea that there were less alehouses because of the traditional ideas of hospitality that you didn't need them as much because it was much more, much less towns and that sort of thing. But certainly from the 17th century, they're really popping up everywhere. You know, you can see by the licensing of this huge increase in them, just as there is everywhere else. But it's really good that Christina is able to look back further and find some evidence for it, because it's not been studied really at all for Ireland yet.
No, that makes it bad. Her book. Yes.
That'll
not
be
for
out.
This Christmas. That'll... Not for this Christmas, but it's coming. It's coming. So
next soon. Christmas.
Yeah. Soon. But back to you, Susan, because I've been fascinated with your work. I'm just really, really curious. Do you have any other publications besides the documentary coming out about maybe more of the details of like the recipe and sort of how that came about?
Yeah, we published the full findings in the historical journal. It just came out quite recently, and that publication is called Understanding Early Modern Beer, and it's open access, so anybody can read it. And I'm very proud to say that it's not it's an academic publication, but it's very accessible. We've had lots of people kind of contacting us saying, you know, thanks for writing something that everybody can understand, so it's not bogged down and sort of probably part of that's probably because I'm not a brewer, so I have to understand it. I had to understand it myself, so it's kind of written so it's like as I'm puzzling it out as we go along. So yeah, that's the main output from it. And then on our food court website, there's a little exhibitions page where we've got a sort of a mini exhibition, just a summary of what we did with nice pictures and things like that, so people can read an abbreviated version of it as well.
Awesome. And for listeners, we will link everything in the show notes so you can just directly go right to it and find all these things for yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe if we shift over a little bit to that brew house they let you build to really kind of test things out, kind of what was that process? Obviously, you had done all the research leading up to that, but then curious kind of the logistics of actually making it happen.
The logistics. Well, first of all, we had a trial run in the March just as COVID was starting and everything shut down. So the Wealden Downing Museum is in a living history museum, if people aren't familiar with it, in Sussex, and it is just the best place ever. It's like stepping back in time. So sort of endangered houses are taken down and then they're rebuilt brick for brick. So you can walk through Saxon houses, 18th century houses, Tudor houses, and the Tudor house is basically set up. It has a fire. It's got, you know, it's what you'd expect a Tudor house to be, but people obviously brewed at home a lot as well. So we were able to bring our equipment in there and just repurpose it. Basically, it was really, really Mark the brewer felt it was really important to brew in sort of an authentic space, because the space that you work in affects everything that you do, and so it took us that much closer to the processes of the past as well. So the space, we were lucky. Again, there were things to think about. The water was obviously important, so we sort of thought about a few different venues, but the water quality there was very similar to what was in Dublin, so that was important to us as well. Then the equipment, that was very interesting, because it was just, you know, I think that sort of sustainability issue turns up a lot in the issues that we faced. And then there was one cooper left, one independent cooper left in the UK to make the barrels, and he's now retired. So there doesn't seem to be a cooper that can do that now. There wasn't a coppersmith in Ireland or the UK. So that big copper came from Portugal. And then the smaller bits of equipment, we were just so lucky because the historical interpreters that work on the site are just so skilled. They can whittle up a brewing ore sort of in. We've got, you know, footage of that where Adrian is just literally making one outside the door. You need one of those. Okay, here's one I whittled earlier. And then, you know, there was a basket weaver working there as well. And again, these are people that put on displays of heritage crafts for people sort of during the week. But Mark gave her sort of an image of what a Wilch, the filtration system would have looked like. And then she went away and sort of made a prototype and then made that, you know, using her skills and that. So it was amazing to see all those people brought together in that space too. And then to be able to give them a voice in the documentary to talk about their crafts and that. Because again, all of these are crafts that are dying out. And I think the project in one way highlighted just how urgent it is to sort of try and preserve those crafts, or we won't have them. We won't have those skills in the future.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that part was so fascinating. That was where she was showing the weaving, and there was sort of like a, we hope this works, but you know, again, some of this has to be guesswork. But it also seems so, you know, when you have someone who had the knowledge of how these things should work, it seems almost obvious to them. So I think there is that piece too of just having these different, again, the interdisciplinary, I think, nature of it is just so helpful.
Then there were a lot of moments though, it was like, oh, please God, let it work. Because you're standing there in front of it and nothing's coming out. And there was one day where it just went horribly wrong. And the part of it was because we were, the film crew were there, and that does change the dynamic of what's happening. So there may have been a little bit too much stirring, for example, because it's like, can you just stir it for a few more minutes for the camera? And the combination of having a very high oak content, the water was a little bit too hot. We stirred it too much, and we basically produced a very expensive vat of porridge. Yeah, and it was an awful feeling where it should have poured out through the Welsh and nothing came out. We're like, oh no, and trying to get rid of that, it was just trying to dispose of a mash tun full of porridge was just a and then it was really worrying because no one had done this before, so if it went wrong, we didn't really know why at that stage, and we didn't know, it was at the start of the project, is it all going to go wrong, and have we just completely wasted our time with this? So there were tense moments like that.
Speaking of sort of crafts and craftsmen and things that, you know, might not exist anymore, I thought it was really interesting how you went about locating sort of the hops you chose and the malts you chose in the documentary, and I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, the hops, we worked with Peter Darby, who was kind of running the Hops Association. He's an expert on hops. The only information I knew I had was that in the records, it does state, obviously they're imported in the 16th century, and they don't have names, so they're not... You might have like Alsacian hops, or that the what we knew from the accounts that we needed Flemish hops. That's all it says. They're not described in any way. So we needed sort of a heritage hop that had roots in Flanders that was still growing. And they're not even growing in the Low Countries now. So it was sort of, it was finding this hop called Tolhurst, which is a descendant of the Flemish Redbine. And still grows in the UK. There's five plants, two at the National Hops Collection, and three belonging to a lovely woman called Dorothy Hollenby, who's also in Sussex. And so for about 3 years, the Hops Collection and Dorothy were collecting their because these five plants produce tiny amounts of hops, and we just wanted, everything had to be right. And so we waited basically, and then she'd pick it and send it to me, and I'd freeze it. By the end of 3 years, there was packets of hops in various people's freezers all around trying to keep them. And then we still couldn't get there. I mean, again, this was a real problem because there was one summer where the heat, it was so hot that all the hops died. And that's happening again. And in fact, she's just told me now that she's no longer growing Tolhurst because it doesn't survive the heat.
Oh gosh,
And so we were so down to the wire that literally, as you saw in the documentary, we were picking that year's harvest the day before we brewed. So we had to rush them down to the museum and get them ready to use. So yeah, that was there was also a case where a batch of hops went missing. It got sent to Trinity College instead of to the UK during COVID, got lost from the university, got sent back to the UK and went missing. A courier lost it. It was going around in the system for days. And of course, I was frantic because this was 3 years down the line and we needed a couple more ounces. We got there in the end, but it was lots of tense moments. So that was that. And the grains, we knew we needed bear barley. There's quite a few references to bear in the accounts. No, there wasn't any bear growing commercially in Ireland then. And so we went to Orkney for that and worked at the Agronomy Institute for bear then. And that was really important because the Landrace barleys, they're very different. You know, they're grown much taller. They've got a different root system. And there hasn't been a huge amount of research on the significance of that in terms of what you produce. So that was important. And again, it's a compromise because we don't have an equivalent in Ireland And land races are different wherever you put them. That's the whole point. So again, it's not the same as what would have been in 16th century Ireland, but it's as close as we could get really to that. So that was sourced on Orkney, and then it was sent to Warminster Maltings for malting, because it's the oldest maltings in the UK, and they still use traditional floor malting practices. So that was as close again as we could get to that too.
Oh, I know, it's so cool. and I guess too, like, it's because obviously this was more than a step up, if you like, from what people would have been making just domestically. Like, this, they were obviously producing at Dublin Castle for large amounts of workers, so this is, I don't want to say commercial necessarily, but it's for a lot of people. It's a big operation, so it's obviously different from what would have been made by people in their homes. But I guess, would you have had a larger scale at that point, or would this be kind of the maximum that you would see? I know I don't have a good sense of this, but
I work out that they're producing about 207,000 pints a year. So that is quite a lot of And domestic brewing is huge. I mean, there's so many complaints. There's a complaint in particular in Cork about a brewer saying there's no work for me because everybody's brewing their own beer. It's huge in that period. And so there are bigger, I suppose, especially once hops becomes more established, then you start to get slightly bigger, more commercial breweries, because the beer that's produced lasts a bit longer. Mm-hmm. And so then it starts to commercialize. But even into the 17th century in Ireland, it's a mixture, you know, these sort of big centers like Dublin, you probably have some bigger outfits, but mostly around the country, it's still sort of small scale domestic brewing. But I would say, because a lot of people are comparing this to like Norwegian farmhouse brewing stuff, it's absolutely nothing like that. It's much more scaled up, and it's much more sort of semi, the earliest kind of commercialized brewing, I guess, that we can locate. Yeah,
because I do feel like that was one of the takeaways from watching the documentaries you're watching. You're like, oh, there are things about this that resonate if you're a home brewer, but also you're like, oh, but this is scaled up. This is not what I would do at home, even now. It was, you know, a more, if you like, professionalized
Yeah, and of course we had to dramatically scale down from what they were doing, and for because of the equipment size and that. So they would have had much bigger equipment, and even sort of, you know, parts of it were mechanized and that in ways that we'd have no idea, you know, and that. But yeah, so we had to scale back to make it feasible. But yeah, it is definitely much more on the sort of early commercial scale than anything else.
Yeah, and Christine, I'm taking a mental note. I feel like maybe you and Liam need to go figure out that the bit about the mechanization that we don't know. I feel like he might know these things. So Liam, if you're listening, just maybe there's another book in there for someone. So as always, more research is needed.
More research is needed, yeah.
Well, there's at the National Museum of Archaeology, there's medieval massive brewing pans that you can go see, which are really, really cool. And I highly encourage everyone to go have a look. They're huge. Like, they're huge, some of them. So that can kind of give you an idea of, like, and that's medieval. But I will say it's really interesting because, yeah, the complaints about, from Susan Zero, like, everybody brewing is just so funny, like, to me, like, it, like, in the best way. It's just really interesting. Because it seems to have changed from the medieval period. So in a lot of other countries, you have this situation where you're actually, you know, concentrating brewing into fewer hands, where in Ireland, it's like the opposite. We're getting more people brewing from what had happened in like earlier periods of medieval Ireland. So I find that all very, very fascinating, but I'm not going to reveal my whole book. but yeah, no, very, very cool. Very cool. So what is next for you in sort of the beer horizon, or what else is coming out of this project, or what else would you like to share with us?
Well, yeah, I mean, beer sort of took over for a while, but there is a lot of other work sort of ongoing at the moment. We're interested in, one aspect of this is that we're interested in trying to understand if there's evidence in the skeletons that we've been looking at for beer drinking. So there's a sort of a side project on isotope analysis, looking at oxygen isotopes to see if we can, it's very experimental, but to see if we could even pinpoint at the sort of the life in the life cycle when people started to drink more. Because when you brew beer, if you brew or stew the water before you drink it, it changes the isotope. The isotope, so it looks different than if you're drinking lots of water, for example. So we're trying to understand that. So some of that beer was sent to Janet Montgomery in Durham, and she's been working on it to see how it changed the isotopes. And then we're also looking at that, trying to find evidence for that in the skeletons as well. So that's an interesting one. And then there's all the other outputs. There's a book that looks at food in general by different food type, sort of trying to look at the cultural significance of food as well as consumption, and beer is just one chapter in that, but we're trying to contextualize that in terms of the broader food package, really. And then each work, you'll be interested in this, Lisa, in particular. We've got one project where we've basically taken the evidence from excavation reports from around 200 sites around Ireland, and we've got a very big database now, so we're trying to see if we can look at the geography of food. So, so can we see, for example, can we correct some of the myths? So again, this idea that everybody just lived on oat cakes, that the Irish didn't eat any meat, and that everybody was religious and fasted all the time. We're able to correct almost all of those myths by looking at the sort of, you know, the archaeological evidence now
in conjunction
with the skeleton and skeletal evidence. And that takes us to places that we can't really get with the historical record, because we can look at Dublin Castle, for example.
Yeah.
But we need to work with other people, especially archaeologists, to see if this is typical and what we can find elsewhere. So we're complicating ideas about food and drink by bringing everyone together to look at it in detail.
Oh, it's a good complication. We love that. Yeah,
it's a good complication. Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. I don't know. So I know, you made the beer, and maybe we'll talk for a moment about how did you find it when you finally tasted it?
Did you see my face on that?
It was a unique look.
That was one of those moments where people laughed. It was completely unintentional. To be fair, it had been sitting around for a while at that stage, and it doesn't keep, even with hops, it really doesn't keep. So it was quite bitter. It was very light colored, I guess. I didn't expect that because of the oats. I don't know why I expected it to be heavy, but it was really, you know, very pale, light drinkable beer. I could see why you could drink a lot of it. I guess it was quite refreshing, maybe. But it tasted almost like cidery. It was very, the hops was very mild. It tasted quite almost more fruity, I guess. Yeah. I think the Bear barley produces quite mild beers as well. And those older hops are very, very mild compared to what people are used to drinking now, those IPAs and that. So yeah, it was quite mild. But yeah, it was nice, but I'm not sure I'd want to drink lots of it.
Yeah. And I know all of our homebrewers listening are hearing you say sort of cidery, and they are assigning different flaws, you know, different faults to it. You know, right now they're doing their thing, but
someone out there is thinking acetaldehyde right now.
Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting. And again, I'm sure there are people who would love to geek out about kind of, you know, the yeast element. And again, you know, that's such a sort of wild card, because there's no way to have basically a yeast from that era. I mean, it will have evolved beyond, you know, whatever that was.
Exactly. You have to make decisions. So there's things that we get as close as we possibly can. We worked with microbiologists who worked with the National Yeast Collection in the UK to find the sort of closest living ancestor to beer clade one, which is on sort of the yeast family tree. It's the closest living ancestor to the first standardized beer yeast, because there weren't any pure cultures until 1880. So so that's as close as we could get. And there's been questions kind of about mixed fermentation and, you know, contamination of the yeast and that, because it's quite an open process. And I guess what John, our microbiologist, has said is that it would probably have been a problem if we continued on for months down the line and it became contaminated, but that one yeast would always be dominant in any case, and that even choosing one back then, all yeast would have been mixed to a certain extent.
Yeah.
So again, it's just, you know, it's doing the best you can. So again, it was really interesting to see how that yeast worked, though, because we had a control batch where we used ringwood ale yeast, which is kind of a sort of semi-modern one. And in those conditions, the beer just died. It became contaminated and grew bacteria really quickly, whereas our old yeast did seem to be designed to work under those conditions. It was really very quick and it worked very well. So that's interesting. But I guess if we were going to, the next stage would probably be to do very detailed fermentation studies, if you were repeating it over and over again, to see what does grow in that sort of environment and the impact that has on flavor and on alcohol production, things like that too.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think, you know, we have no way of knowing, again, what would have made those workers back in the day complain? Like, would it have been that it was weaker? Would it have been the flavor? Would it have been a color? Like, we just don't know what might have, you know, set them off.
Well, they do complain. Yeah. They complain when the beer is too sharp, for example, and when the beer is too sour, and then they refuse to drink it and that. So they are used to drinking it before it goes off, before it turns to vinegar, which is quickly. Yeah. So they are sort of used to sweeter beers probably. Mm. Yeah. They do complain a lot about bad quality beers.
Yeah. And Christina, you probably have all kinds of stuff in your forthcoming books on people complaining about beer that's gone off
I'm not going to get too much into it, but there's a really funny letter by a monk who's in Belgium who complains about the beer in Belgium being so bad that it should be tortured in hell.
Ah, the Belgians, do they even know about beer? I mean, come on. Oh, that's funny.
Well, yeah, I mean, as long as people have been making beer, there have been people leaving like bad their version of Untappd reviews. So...
someone always has a more sophisticated palate than everyone else. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, but then that's probably like a question for future research is, you know, we know that this is what they were making for the workers to drink. Would it have been different for, you know, the monks are kind of your almost sort of civil service class, or do we know how that broke down at all, or, you know, how those recipes might have differed?
No, not really. I mean, you know, again, to get the exact volumes produced is very rare. So that means everything, doesn't it? So all we can say at that institution is that 80% of what was produced was this so-called ordinary beer.
Yeah.
So we assume there's a record that says that the strong beer was reserved to his lordship only. So there seems to be some. And then, of course, wine drinking is very common, you know, amongst sort of elites and office holders and that too. So it's not just beer. And then there's an urban-rural distinction in that beer does seem to be a more urban drink in this period. Ale is probably still more common in rural areas, as well as other drinks. So yeah, again, there's probably a social distinction, but a geographical and regional distinction.
Yeah.
And I guess beer would have been, because it's so variable in terms of what you produce, it would have been different wherever you went.
Yeah. Oh, see, again, so much to study. So
yeah.
So
cool.
And future PhD.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So what is on the front for you going forward? So you've kind of mentioned some of the projects that you're doing with the analysis of beer and food all over Ireland and even when people started drinking, which is really cool. But any interesting future projects that you haven't started yet or maybe in the pipeline or anything like that?
Yeah, I'd like to do some more on bread and beer. Maybe we neglected bread, and I think that would be very interesting as the other sort of staple, and I'm interested in how those quality of those foods change due to industrialization. So maybe looking at before and after, and not just thinking about the way that systemizing food and globalization's impacted on all these things like sustainability and the quality of local produce and the regional variation in that, but thinking about when and why that happened and how that impacts on social and cultural aspects as well. So yeah, maybe more food down the line, but all of this depends on funding, because it's expensive to look at things like that. And again, finding good collaborators and thinking about it. So there's the germ of an idea in that sense, but yeah, it needs a lot of work to think about where we might go with it.
Yeah, as always, more funding is needed too, folks. So that's, you know, think good thoughts. Yes.
Yeah.
Very good. Do you have any final questions, Lisa?
Oh, I mean, I feel like I could ask all sorts of nerdy questions about it all evening. But I think for me, it's really just once the documentaries available for others to watch. I would be really curious to see if, again, homebrewers and other kind of interested people sort of take it and run with it, almost try to, you know, do their own version and see if people almost, you know, compare, contrast, see what they come up with. I'd love to see how it comes out differently under different conditions. And
I would say that's one thing we didn't do was sort of use those, use that and do it under a modern with modern equipment, because that would be a very interesting kind of control, you know, to see if that made any difference, because then you could get a better insight into what the significance of the technology was. Mm-hmm. Again, yeah, it's just again things that you can't necessarily do now because of the shortage of those ingredients. But yeah, there's other people growing heritage crops at the moment, like Morris DC at Canvas Brewing, who's working on, who I think you spoke to as well. So there's the thing, things have evolved since we started this. So I think I feel much more hopeful with people like Morris working on these things now, that there's going to be room for these things done and done without having to go all over Europe or the British Isles to get ingredients. So that's really hopeful in terms of experimentation down the line.
Yeah, even if it's just on a small scale, you know, that's a start, mm-hmm. and see where that goes. And I'd be curious too to see if there are these other kind of pockets, if you like, of either, you know, heritage grains that people don't even know are out there. You know, maybe they're just in someone's, you know, left field, and who knows. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, that's an interesting point. Yeah. So watch this space, I suppose.
Yes.
Yes.
And we will have you back on.
Yes, absolutely. That would be great.
Yeah. And yes, so listeners, we will have all of this linked so you can go watch the documentary when it's out, and you can read their article and get to read more and see the pictures and stuff about the project. So we will have all that for you down in the show notes. And I want to say thank you to Susan again so much for coming on the show. Do you want to give our listeners your any of your social media accounts so they can follow you and follow along with the project?
My God, I can't remember. I'm not on social media very much, but the best place to follow the project at the moment, I am on Twitter or whatever it's called now. I think it's at Susan Flavin, or maybe at Flavin Susan. I can't remember. But yeah, and on the Food Cult website, I keep that up to date. So anything that we're doing, I usually put a news feature up there. So it's just foodcult.eu. So everything's up to date there. Yeah. And find me on Twitter. I am there. I just can't remember what that looks like.
Yeah. We'll find the right one and we'll put that in the show notes.
Yeah, don't worry. We will. Yeah. And again, we'll say to people, you know, go watch the documentary when you can. Again, shout out for those little animations too, the sort of woodcut style. They were amazing.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. That's fantastic. Yeah. It's Marianne, the animator. That was one of the most exciting things for me, just to see those woodcuts brought to life. So yes, when the documentary is available, you need to wait till the very end, because that's where those woodcuts are brought to life. And it's lovely to see.
It really is. It's a fantastic project. I think we were excited to get that sneak peek, but just thrilled to have you here, because I think, again, there's so much we could talk about. And again, to talk too about kind of beer's role in this kind of wider food culture, mm-hmm. And again, how it's different things to different people, different times. There's just like, there's so much to geek out about. So,
yeah. Well, thanks for having me. It's been great. Great to chat.
Definitely. And we definitely hope to have you back again soon to talk about more of your research and more things that you find. Sure. So thank you so, so much, Susan, for coming on. And we really appreciate it. And thank you all for listening. And hopefully you will come back and listen to us soon. Goodbye.
Bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.